Tonight, we have a very special guest, Dr. Melissa Franklin. Dr. Franklin is the chair of the physics department at Harvard. She is born and raised Canadian. She earned her BSc from the University of Toronto, her PhD from Stanford. She was, in 1992, the first female tenured physics professor at Harvard. Yes, congratulations. Melissa, come on.
Hi. So first of all, I'm incredibly happy to be invited by the Perimeter, first of all, because it's a theoretical institute and I'm an experimentalist. And a lot of my talk is going to be about being an experimentalist and try and give you some idea of what that's like. I know you don't really want to be inside my head, but I'm going to put you there for a little while. First of all, I just want to situate us. So here's an atom. Here is a nucleus, which is smaller, you can see, 10,000 times smaller. Here's a proton. Inside the proton are quarks. Here's electrons from the atom, which are also very small. These things are actually, as far as we know, smaller than 10 to the minus 18 centimeters, which is billions and billions small. I'm going to not talk about anything here. Atoms are too useful. So I'm going to just go down to the bottom where we have quarks, and I'm going to talk about the quarks and the leptons, but I'm really not going to talk about them very much. I'm just going to use them. I'm going to talk a little bit about the particles which make forces happen, but really I'm going to talk about this thing that's gray, and it's gray because it's a very deep particle called the Higgs. It's called the Higgs boson, and we possibly discovered it and announced it last July 4th, this past summer. And I want to tell you what I felt. I mean, I'm on the experiment, and I want to tell you what I felt, and then I want to tell you what happened after I felt what I felt. When we actually made the announcement, I was walking down the street later. It was in the middle of the night. I was walking down the street, and I felt weird. And I felt that I was walking through the Higgs field, because the Higgs is a field which permeates all of space, any vacuum, anything. It's just there, and it interacts with all of matter, and I'm made of matter. What happened was this. Someone asked me, and they had a recorder, and I said, for the first time, I feel the Higgs field. And another professor in my department told a whole bunch of students that I was a goofball because he had been feeling the Higgs field for a long time. And this is a kind of important thing. So now, when I walk down the street, I'm thinking about the Higgs field that I'm walking through, I say out loud. It feels weird. Theorists have been feeling this weirdness for a long time. Turns out they already knew there was a Higgs field, and they knew it for sure in 1982 when we discovered the W and Z bosons, which I'll talk to you about. The W and Z are sort of, they have part of the Higgs field in them, in a way. So these theorists were saying, I knew the Higgs field was there, and I've been walking through it, and that's why I've been weird the whole time. Finally, I understood. And I had been thinking, no, you're wrong. And so I think this is, here's a theorist here. Oh, I have a hockey stick. Here's a theorist. He's in my department. His name is Howard George, a brilliant, brilliant guy. But you see the weirdness there. And here's me. This is, of course, my self-portrait. So theorists and experimentalists are different. And I don't know if you can tell already, but there is a relationship between them. Theorists sort of study exact symmetries of an approximate world. So they sort of have a theory, which is approximate, and then they look at the symmetries of it. And so that they sort of look at the concepts of the theories. And experimentalists measure the world wrapped in fog. It's messy, it's dirty. People call it actually dirty. And this is the kind of thing they look at, and they try and see this. So you can't always see that. And so this man, Howard Georgi, well, there's a long story, and I'm just going to tell it to you. When I was very young, not too young, about as young as 23, this man wrote an article in a journal called Physics Today, and it said, look, this is the difference between experimentalists and theorists. It's like truffle farmers. When you look for truffles, he said, the theorists are the farmers. They sort of know where to look for the truffles. The experimentalists are the pigs, who are very good at finding the truffles if someone points them in the direction. Okay. So, I'm trying to get back to why I didn't think I was walking through the Higgs field before. At that point, I said to myself, I do not want to talk to any more theorists. I don't want them to show me where to snuffle. So, I really didn't pay any attention to them. And this is kind of an experimentalist's view. It used to be, when I grew up, that experimentalists rode horses, they drank bourbon, they got very drunk, and they worked all night. Theorists have soft faces, and they drink all night. Okay, so experiments are a little different because we think more like this. Here's a philosopher, he's a Canadian guy, Ian Hacking, who once wrote in a book on scientific reality, if you can spray it, it's real. And to me, that's sort of right. You know, if I can actually spray something, then I know it exists. Higgs field? Not so sure. But I can spray electrons, and I can spray quarks now. I'm going to talk about that today. And I can spray gluons. I'm a good gluon sprayer. I can spray Ws. I can almost sort of spray top quarks in a way. So far, I can't spray the Higgs. So Higgs, among other theorists, solved the theoretical problem that I'm going to talk about. We didn't believe it. That's me, the queen and I. And we were all Higgs Schmigs. I don't know how many times I wrote Higgs Schmids on transparencies. Don't tell me what to look for, but we looked for it in our spare time. So, waking up to the Higgs, that's July 5th. Sweet dream or nightmare? And here I don't mean a nightmare in the sense of, it's a nightmare for the physicists. Or is it a sweet dream for physicists? For you guys, I think it's pretty much the same, although you might feel that tingling feeling after this talk. This talk is about finding the Higgs and what happens to us next. Now, we found a Higgs boson. Interesting thing about the Higgs boson is it has no spin. So I'll tell you what spin is. It's a particle. It couples to everything. It couples to quarks, and it couples to W bosons, and it couples to itself. Okay? There are quarks and leptons. There are force carriers like the W and Z and the gluon. There are photons. The Higgs has a mass. It's 125 GeV. And the mass of the Higgs particle, why do I keep using this? Now I'm going to trip. Okay. The mass of the Higgs particle that we measure is one thing, but the fact that there's a Higgs particle, just like the fact that there's a W and Z, means there's a Higgs field. And that is what's really exciting to learn about. Here's a particle. Particles normally rotate, or they have angular momentum, even if they don't rotate. So there's something called spin. Every elementary particle has spin. Okay? So here's an electron, and you can see that it has a little bit of angular momentum, as if it's spinning around an axis. Okay? So spin is quantized, which means that you can't just get any value of spin, any value of angular momentum. You can just get 0, 1/2, 1, 3/2, 2, etc. So bosons have spin 0, 1, or 2, the ones we've seen, and fermions have spin 1/2, 3/2, etc. So you need to know this just to be able to go through the rest of the lecture. Higgs should have spin 0. And just so you know, that's called a scalar. And we don't have any other particles like that, elementary particles. What is a particle? So there's two kinds of particles. There's stable particles, like the electron or the proton. And there's unstable particles, like the top quark or the Higgs. So an unstable particle decays randomly. So for instance, a top quark will decay in 10 to the minus 24 seconds to a W boson and a bottom quark. So these are just the particles that I showed you on the very first slide. They're just all the elementary particles of our standard model. So we call something an invariant mass It's the mass, it's the characteristic of the particle that never changes, okay? It can go fast or slow or do anything, but the mass is always the same. And that's something we're very interested in, and that's something we look for. So, for instance, in this decay of the top quark, it decays to a W and a bottom quark. And when we measure the mass of the W and bottom quark, we're measuring the mass of the top quark. So that's really easy. So we can just look at the particles that come from a decay, and we can construct the characteristic mass of the decay. Okay, so what am I talking about? It's a really weird concept, and so I thought I'd drink. I'm just sorry, I'm putting my finger in vinegar. Okay. So here's a classical resonance. This is a wine glass, and you know that if you put your finger in vinegar, I've never done that. When you make a wine glass resonate, okay, what is happening? You're making the, I'll show you later, the wine glass is actually moving back and forth, okay? And what happens is when you try and make it resonates for a certain amount of time, right? If I do this properly and it sings, it can sing and then it'll stop singing, okay? And it'll sing with a certain loudness. So what I'm showing you here is just the resonance of a wine glass. So this axis is power that is absorbed by the wine glass, okay, just or how much it's singing. And this is the frequency. And so there's a resonant frequency, and there's the width of this curve, which tells you how long the resonance lasts for. Okay? So this is something you've seen all the time in your life, this kind of resonance. And it turns out it's exactly the same as a quantum mechanical particle. So there's a resonant frequency, there's a width. Both of those things are characteristic of the wine glass. Every wine glass is different. Every wine glass will have one frequency that it sings at, and it'll have one lifetime of that resonance. Okay, so now let's look at a quantum mechanical particle. Quantum mechanical particle will have exactly the same shape, except instead of a frequency, characteristic frequency, there will be a mass, the mass of the particle. That's what's characteristic. And instead of the power absorbed or the loudness, you will have the number of particles that you make. So when you make a resonance, when you make a particle like a Higgs particle, which will then decay, when you make it, it will decay with a mass spectrum like this. This will be the characteristic mass. And this width here will be 1 over the lifetime of the particle. So it'll be proportional to the lifetime of the particle. Exactly the same physics, pretty much. So if you are looking for a Higgs particle or a top particle or a Z particle, you will look for this shape. So let's just look what we see here. If you're looking for the Z boson, you're going to look at the mass. That's the characteristic of that particle. You're going to let the Z decay to a muon, two muons, and you're going to look at those muons, and you're going to see this shape here. So this is exactly the same shape. This is the number of times you do this, the number of times you make a Z, and the mass of the two particles that the Z decays into. Here's when we discovered the top quark in 1995. This is the similar shape. Can you see the shape there? We make top quarks. We let them decay. We reconstruct the mass of the top quark, the characteristic mass. We get something about 170 GeV, 170 proton masses. And this is the number of events. So this is just 1, 2, 3 events here. So again, we claim this blue shape is the same shape as a resonance. Okay? We go through and look at lots of different particles, and we always see this same shape. Sometimes it's on a background. Like here at the end, it's on a background, but it's always the same shape. So all we have to do, this is all we have to do. Actually, what's bad about this talk is that after I give it, you're going to know as much as I do. All we have to do is make new particles, look at their decay products, make this mass, and see what it looks like. See if there's a bump. That's all we have to do. Okay, so I need to tell you a few things first. I need to tell you about couplings. There are three forces that we know what to do with, and then there's gravity. I'm not going to talk about gravity, but I might actually fall, which would then be, of course, okay. We don't have a quantum theory of gravity yet, so I'm not going to talk about it. But we do know how electromagnetism works. We know how magnetic fields and electric fields work. We know how the strong force which holds the protons together work, and holds the nucleus together work, and we know how radioactive decay goes. So this is the electromagnetic interaction, and this is what we think. We think electron is moving along in time, and it can emit a photon, okay? And that probability of emitting a photon has a size, small. It's less than one. A quark can be going along and emit a gluon, okay? And that has a coupling as well. So coupling is how likely is it that a quark will emit a gluon? Weird thing is, a gluon can also emit a gluon. But a photon can't emit a photon. Okay, so these seem really weird, okay? But if you just concentrate for a minute and think, let me imagine that these do exist, that these things do exist, that I can have a top quark decaying to a bottom quark and a W boson, imagine that those things really do exist. You don't have to really get it, but what you can say is, I can put these things all together and make some really interesting things. So let's see what we can do. First of all, let's talk about Higgs. Higgs is H, and the whole idea of Higgs is that it couples, and this is coupling, to everything, fermions, bosons, everything. So it couples to top, anti-top quarks, antimatter. It couples to electrons and positrons. It couples to, here, W plus and W minus, Zs. And interestingly enough, the Higgs can couple to itself. So the idea is that these couplings of the Higgs to these particles gives them mass. So the idea is when I'm walking down the street through this Higgs field, that in fact, this is what's happening. Okay, so it's kind of beautiful. I'm going to take these diagrams and these diagrams, and I can say this. Everything which is not forbidden is compulsory, okay? So, yeah, energy has to be conserved, and angular momentum has to be conserved, and momentum has to be conserved, but if it can happen, it will. And all I do, my whole job, and the reason they pay me so much money, is to figure out how often. Okay? How often does it happen? So look what I can do. Just with the couplings I showed you, I can take two gluons, I can make a top and one can make a top and an anti-top, the other one can make a top and an anti-top, they can eat each other. The top and anti-top can make a Higgs, because we know that coupling exists. Then the Higgs can go to ZZ, because we know that coupling exists. And then the Z can go to mu mu, because we know, look, we know all these couplings exist. Therefore, this exists. Therefore, I can make it if I have a beam of gluons. You put all these things that you know can happen together, and you know you could make a Higgs, and the Higgs would decay to a ZZ, and you just have to find them, and that's all you do, and you spend day and night. Okay, what is a field, you're thinking? It's a really hard concept, but the one I like best is the wind field. That's wind. This is the United States of America. At every point in America, there's a wind direction and a wind speed. Every point, and so that's a field. There's a Higgs field. What does the Higgs field really mean? It's something that's defined at every point in space. There's a guy who came about 5 years ago, a theorist, and he said, Higgs field's like a snow field. He said, since the Higgs field interacts with all particles, then you can just imagine a Higgs field is like a snow field. The particle is like a skier. If the skier has skis, then he goes really fast, or she, And that's like having a small mass. And if the skier has no skis and feet, and the feet go all the way through the thunder, then it's very hard walking through the field. It's very hard. And you go slowly, and that's like having a high mass. So these kind of analogies don't make any sense to me. I know that it's because I'm not deep, but I just want to mention very briefly that this is how we dress in the lab. These are the particles we're talking about. These are the quarks, up, down, charm, strange, top, bottom, neutrinos, electron, muon, tau, and these are the force carriers, the photon, the gluon, photon for electromagnetism, gluon for strong force, and the Z and W for the weak force, okay? So here's the deal. Without the Higgs field, the WZ and the fermions would be massless. However, we happen to have measured the W, all of these masses. They're all massive, except for the photon. We measured them, and so there was a problem, and everybody was scratching their head, and a lot of them are bald now. So this is my one theory slide. Here's the standard model. That L has everything in the standard model that we know, tells us all about these couplings and these interactions. If I just add the Higgs field to it and put it in this machine, which is what theorists do, the theorists not only know how to crank this machine, they know what to put in it. And out comes the Higgs boson, and all the particles have mass. This is good. This is pretty good. Don't you like this? I love this guy. Okay, so with an accelerator, I just want to let you know why we use accelerators, because sometimes it's not so clear. We can do two things. We can look at very small things very carefully with high resolution, or we can make very massive particles by saying, I put a lot of energy into the particles in the accelerator, I collide them, and then I have a lot of energy, which can then become a lot of mass. So I can make new particles like the Higgs. I worked on an experiment for 27 years. We were looking for the Higgs. We didn't find it because we didn't have enough energy, and that was very sad. Luckily, I was on two experiments at the same time, so I had covered my odds. Okay, so we're at the energy frontier. No matter what people say about quantum computing or anything else, we rock because we have so much energy, it's unbelievable, and no one else has that. Okay, so if we know quantum mechanics, this is just one thing I want to tell you in case you don't know. If you know quantum mechanics, you can say particles behave like waves. So there I've shown a wave, and there's sort of a particle, and waves have wavelengths. So the green there is one wavelength of this wave. So imagine a proton, for instance, or a quark, or an electron. All of them can be described by a wave packet like that, either a particle moving through space or a wave. It has a wavelength, and the great thing about quantum mechanics is it says the momentum, or the mass times velocity of this particle, is equal to some constant, some guy Planck, over the wavelength. So that means if the wavelength is very, very small, the momentum is very, very big. Or conversely, if I make the momentum very, very big, the wavelength will be very, very small. So what does that mean? Small wavelength, if I hit something with a small wavelength, I can see really, really deep inside it with very good resolution. And here's the only other analogy I will use, and I apologize. If you're a skier, again, it's a skiing theme, going down a hill with a little crevasse here, if you have really big skis, you will never know, will rarely know that it's there. However, if you have little skis, you will definitely find it. The analogy here is the length of the ski is the wavelength. Okay, I agree. But I like that. I particularly like his nose. Okay, so that's all you need to know why we need accelerators. All we want to do is get a really little wavelength so we can look really deep inside things like quarks. Okay? So this is what I do every day. I get up in the morning, and after I've walked through the Higgs field, I look at little things with light from the sun. The light comes down, it has some wavelength, it scatters off into my eye. My eye is connected to a brain, which is shrinking. The brain is connected to my lips, and my lips might say, dog. Is it a very small dog I'm looking at? Okay, this is sort of what we've been doing for the last 40 years, or 100 years. I have an accelerator. I make any wavelength I want, but not smaller than 10 to the minus 18 meters, which is 1 billionth of a billionth of a meter. I look at something like, for instance, a quark. I build a detector that costs $200 million. I make a digital brain that takes me 12 years. I fill up a lot of CDs, CDs that go to the moon and back. And that's what accelerators do, okay? So in order to make a really small wavelength, I just need make a really high momentum. How do I do that? I really need a pointer. I need to accelerate the particles. I accelerate them with electromagnetic fields. It's like a car battery, really. Instead of putting your finger across the two things, you would put a particle across the two terminals, and it would get accelerated. You really want to accelerate these things a lot because you want the momentum to be as high as you can. So you do this many, many times. So you have to put them in a circle. Once you have, you know, so they go, they accelerate, they go around, they accelerate, they go around, they accelerate. That's really good, except if you want them to go around, you need magnets. And so what I've shown down here is the LHC tunnel, the Large Hadron Collider tunnel in CERN. That's where our experiment is. That's where we found the Higgs possibly particle, the possibly Higgs particle. And what you see there, all those blue things, are superconducting magnets. Those are magnets that are so great because they use superconducting wire, which has no resistance. So you don't have to spend a lot of energy. Okay, so that was the whole accelerator thing. What do you want to accelerate? I'm going to accelerate protons. Protons are really weird. That's a proton. It doesn't actually have the shell. But this part. There's up quarks, two up quarks, a down quark. Then there's all kinds of gluons. These are gluons in here. And then there's also anti-quarks in there. When you accelerate a proton, and you accelerate it really fast, it doesn't seem like a proton. It seems like a beam of all of those particles, not even talking to each other. Okay? So here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to accelerate protons coming this way and protons coming this way. I'm going to collide them. And so what's going to happen is that one of these quarks or gluons is going to interact with one from the other side, and I'm going to have a very high energy interaction. That high energy can create new particles. So what you see down here is actually two protons coming in, one here, a quark from one and a gluon from other, interacts, has a hard interaction, and then something comes out, in this case, a photon and a jet. Okay? So this down here looks really complicated, but it basically is just saying this is what we're doing. We're going to collide protons and protons. It's really going to be like colliding quarks and gluons. And then we're going to see, clearly, we can collide gluons and gluons. And remember, gluons and gluons can give you a Higgs particle. Okay? Does that make any sense? I have to tell you, there's like 30 years of physics in this one thing here. Okay? There's like, I don't know how many Nobel Prizes and a huge amount of work. But just, you just got to believe me, okay? That was the hockey stick. Okay, so we can use quarks. When we do this, when we use quarks to look inside other quarks, that makes them real, okay? And this is the way we found out that quarks have no structure, as far as we can tell. And we can turn this energy into mass. So that's what we're going to try and do here. Here's the accelerator. It's not really. This red thing is just a line. Anyhow, it is accelerators in Geneva. It's right on the border of Geneva, of Switzerland and France. Here's Lac Léman. There's the, what do you call it? The White Mountain. The Mont Blanc. And underneath, this is a sort of 26-kilometer ring underneath the ground. In that ring, protons go one way, protons go the other way in through superconducting magnets in a vacuum. And what's in the vacuum? Higgs field. I love this. Okay. Okay. So this is beautiful. And when you go there to work, you get to see the Mont Blanc every day. That's the accelerator. It's very complicated because you start with a jar of hydrogen gas, and you end up with protons going 0.9999999991 times the speed of light. Okay? They're going as fast, almost at the speed of light, not quite. The reason you have all this junk in between is sort of like gears. You can't go from a little gear to a huge gear. You have to have a whole bunch of gears in between. Okay, here it looks like this is also a cartoon, but it's 100 meters below ground. This is my experiment, Atlas. So here's the ground. It's very flat. 100 meters down, there's our experiment. There's four experiments. I've covered our competitors up, CMS. These are the beams, and this is they're made to collide. So you have these beams. I'll show you they're going in different directions and in different tubes here. I hope you can see this. It's kind of small. So you have two rings. You have protons going in opposite directions. Each of those yellow things is a bunch of protons. Each bunch of protons is 10 to the 11th protons, roughly. That's a lot. It's less than a trillion, more than 100 billion. These go in opposite directions. They collide every 25 nanoseconds. A nanosecond is 10 to the minus 9 seconds. And there's 2,800 bunches. So we are crossing proton bunches 40 million times a second. Okay? Now, remember, we wanted to know how often that thing I drew, seeing that thing that made a Higgs and it decayed, we want to know how often that happens. It doesn't happen very often. So you really need 40 million times a second to do this. But it is kind of impressive that we were able to do that, and I have to say that that's not really people like me. It's people who are called accelerator physicists who are pretty smart with electromagnetism. They're brilliant. Okay, so what is an event? An event is when one proton collides with a proton and you want to see what happens, okay? But it's really like two gluons colliding, okay? So the protons don't even seem like protons. We just call them protons, okay? So the thing is, when you have a proton-proton collision, you have sort of, when you collide these bunches, you have 10 to the 9, the billion proton-proton collisions per second. And so you have a lot of particles coming out, which I'll show you, okay? And not only that, you can't tell only two protons to interact because other protons might want to interact. So in general, we have 23 proton-proton interactions per crossing, which makes things very complicated, and I'll show you that. Okay, so that's a ridiculous amount of data. So what you need to do is you need a trigger, and you say, I only want to look at certain events, because if I was going to actually read out in my detector and store on a CD all of that data, I would be making, you know, miles and miles of CDs every minute, which would be completely stupid. So you have a trigger, and the trigger is so smart, and it's electronics, and it says which event is interesting, and it's able to reduce it to a rate of 40,000 events per second. Okay, so we write, in terms of data, about 3,200 terabytes a year, and that's equivalent to about 3 billion books. So you can see the need for graduate students. Okay, so it's not actually that, you know, it's not actually that great. It is, when I show it to you, you'll be amazed. But it's just like a 100 megapixel camera, which is something you might even have in your home. But you probably don't have one that takes 40,000 pictures per second. Okay, this is what happens. Let's say protons collide. These are all the charged particles that bend in a magnetic field coming out. This is what you get, one event. and then you have to figure out what happened. This is why we are so incredibly smart. Okay, so there's 20 kilometers of this superconducting magic. Those guys can't be in there when it's on, because they'll be dead. Okay, these are the two beams, one the proton's going one way, one going the other way. This is what you have to wear because helium can kill you, not directly, if there's a helium leak. So these guys travel around in little carts around this 27 kilometers with, you know, oxygen tanks and stuff. It's cool. You can see I'm not lying because it's Versinex. That's a French thing. Okay, this is me cross-dressing. This is our detector. Look at the size. No, actually, these are French people, which are normal size. This is our detector. This is where the protons collide. This took, you know, 27 countries a lot of time to make, and it works pretty well. The part we made, where I come from, is this part right here, the muon detector. Okay. Sorry, I have to go really, really fast. Look at that! Look at that! No, sorry. That's part of the muon toroid. I just wanted to show you how cool this is. If you're young and you want to help build this, okay. This is lowering what we built at Harvard down into the 100 meters down into the tunnel through some hole. That's just really groovy. Okay, this is the Finnish detector. It's enormous. Those are people, no longer French. Those are Italians. This person, I think, is a Swede. Okay. These are all the countries that work on Atlas. It's a lot. It's the yellow part. Wow. Yeah. Look, Canada! Canada built a huge part of this Atlas detector. Canada's probably the best part. Okay. So, let's go back. Remember this? Okay, we're going to create this Higgs, and then we're going to let it decay. And we're going to look for Z's decaying. And we all know Z decays to 2 leptons. Okay, so I'm just going to look for 4 leptons. A lepton is an electron, or a muon in this case. Okay, so look at this. This is an actual event. Okay, the detector is a cylinder. I'm looking end on the cylinder, okay? In here is where they collide, okay? Then there's a magnetic field, which makes charged particles bend. Then there's all kinds of stuff that tells me the energy of the particles coming out, whether they're muons or not, whether they're electrons, etc. And so here's a really interesting event. The blue muons, 2 muons, and 2 electrons, or 4 muons in this case. I have 4 muons coming out, and I say, oh my God, 4 muons, that could be a Higgs particle. Unfortunately, lots of other things make 4 muons. That's why I spent so much time at the beginning. I wasted all my time telling you about the resonance, right? Because lots of people make 4 muons, but not many people make 4 muons with a mass that looks like this. Okay? Isn't this beautiful? Okay, sorry. Okay, here's another Higgs to 4 muons. I'm just showing that events actually happen. Here are the muon tracks. Muons can go through steel. Muons can do anything. That's what I love, muons. Okay. Okay, so what we do is we take a year of events running night and day, colliding beams every 25 nanoseconds. Oh my God, it's hard. Okay. Here's just another one. I'm just showing you nice pictures. And then eventually, we're gonna reconstruct this mass. Remember I talked to you about the mass? But here's the mass. This is from the other experiment, CMS. This is the mass of the ZZ. Remember? I've got a Z and a Z in the final state. So it's the mass of the 4 leptons I saw. This is the mass along here, remember? And this is the number of events. So you're looking at this, right? This blue thing. Background. The blue thing is indeed 4 muons that didn't come from a Higgs. They came from just normal stuff. You just made 2 Zs. Sorry. When I show you the data, you're going to understand why I'm so crazy. Okay. What about, see, these are events. Each one, you know, this is 8, this is 2. So all of a sudden, you've got a little bit too many events right here, right? Just a bit. Okay, so you say to yourself, imagine that was a Higgs particle. If its mass was 126 GeV, what would it look like? And it would look like the orange curve. Okay, so you're saying, are you kidding me? Like, you guys told me you're walking through a Higgs field and this is what you've got? Okay, so, yes. First of all, there are two experiments, and there's a whole bunch of, the Higgs doesn't only decay to two Zs, it can decay to other things. So that's one experiment. This is our experiment. And here you can see, you can see the same thing. Right? So in this case, it's a little bit different. There are a lot of backgrounds. So this, again, is the mass and the number of events. And if I look here at 126, this is what the Higgs would look like. And look at these two things here. There's 8 events here and 7 there. OK, now you know you can say, look, we're not just going to believe you. That's not good enough. These things, what is this? Well, this is just if the Higgs was 150 GeV. Well, it's clearly, there's no events there. And if it was 190 GV, so we keep going and we keep putting these things up and saying, no Higgs, no Higgs. Only here we said, And both experiments said, And not only in one channel, not only in one decay channel. Does this make any sense to you? Okay, this is a small number of events, but because we're so smart, it's sort of like yesterday if you're watching the election when they called Ohio early, sort of like that. Okay, I was going to show you a movie, but then I looked at the time, and I can't show you a movie. But I'll show it later if you ask. And the movie explains, it's kind of a cool movie. I'll show you the movie. It's not that cool, but I made the movie. We're back to the wine glass. I'm trying to get that across. Back to the wine glass. I'm singing to the wine glass. I am a generator. I put a little piece of paper on the wine glass. Look at that. Isn't that cool? The wine glass is resonating. Okay? So I know in my lab I have a wine glass resonating, and then I just add a lot of noise, background noise. And then I say, just make the wine glass resonate a little less, make this sound a little lower. Even with all that noise, you can sort of hear it, right? You can sort of hear a resonance. Can you hear it? That's what we're doing. The Higgs can also decay in other ways once I make it. So I could take two gluons in the same way through top and anti-top, make a Higgs, and then the Higgs could go to WW, and then the photon, look at the photon. The photon has no mass, right? Did you know that? That's why it goes at the speed of light, or whatever. It goes at the speed of light and then has no mass. It doesn't couple to the Higgs. I didn't show you a coupling of photons to the Higgs because the Higgs couples to things that have mass. It has no mass. The Higgs couples more to massive things than unmassive things. So why am I looking for a Higgs decay that goes to photon-photon? Just because we're so cool, we know this can happen. It can decay to Ws, which can, they're charged, so they can couple. They have electric charge, so they can couple to photons. So we are looking at our proton beam, both giving us a gluon, making a Higgs, and coming out at the end is two photons. In my detector, how do I see photons? A photon is not charged. So in this detector here, there's no track, but there's energy in my calorimeter, in my energy measurer. And this is characteristic of a photon. And over here, you can see if I roll out my detector like a map, these are the energy deposits of the two photons, okay? And you say to yourself, wow, Franklin, what are those other blue particles? Remember the other 23 proton-proton collisions? Do you remember that? Yeah. Okay, so again, this is what we're doing. What are the backgrounds? Well, any quark can make two photons. You don't need a... Yeah, this can happen. Remember I said anything can happen if it's not disallowed. So from my protons, I can have a quark and a quark. They can make two photons. Gluons can make photons. A gluon and a quark can make photons. So there's a lot of different backgrounds. So what I'm going to show you now is something that looks like this. This is the data. This is CMS. This is the number of events I see with two photons in the final state. I see a whole lot. And then at 126 GeV, I see these little thing here. Okay? Now that sort of looks like that shape of the resonance on top of a falling distribution. Okay? So this is my Higgs signal. And from my experiment, we have the same thing, the number of events and the mass. And look at this. It's so little that we had to add this part, which is you take this and you subtract this background, what you think is just a normal falling background, and you get this little thing here at 126. Okay, what you have just seen is the most exciting discovery of the 21st century in my field. I just wanted to, in case there was someone who couldn't see, I wanted to blow it up. Okay, so you say to me, I don't believe you, you're a total goofball. I know how to quantify this, so I can ask this question. What is the probability to see what we see in those plots if the Higgs does not exist? Okay, I can ask that question, and I can look, and I can say, what's that probability? Well, this is the mass, again, that I'm looking for, and the probability at 126 is less than 10 to the minus 7. It's small, 0.0000001. So the probability that I would see what I saw if the Higgs doesn't exist is 10 to the minus 7. And for government work, that's pretty good. Sorry, this is a log scale, but this is around 125 GV. It's very, very, very unlikely that we would get that data if the Higgs didn't exist. And this is what made us have that July 4th press conference. Okay, so let's go back. We found those little bumps, and you can say they're little bumps, and they may be significant, but are they the Higgs, right? What do we know about the Higgs? It has spin zero. In our theory, it has spin zero. It couples to particles depending on their mass. So we looked in a whole bunch of different channels where the Higgs decays not just to photon-photon, not just to ZZ, but to things like WW, things like BB, tau-tau. And we looked and we said, if this is where it should be from our theory, these points are what we measure. Okay, so not all the points are right on the theory, so this should be on there. But these red things are error bars. So the red things say how well we know that this point is really here. And so what we want to do is we want to measure all of these things incredibly well so we can see whether they agree with the couplings of the standard model. And then we would say there's a Higgs. Now, if we just run the accelerator, it's going to run, it's going to shut down in February, they're going to fix everything, and then it's going to run at a much higher luminosity for another 10 years, let's say, 5 years. We can measure the mass better, and by the way, we want to make sure that in every channel you measure, the mass is the same. It would be terrible if the Higgs wasn't just one mass. Well, it wouldn't be the Higgs. It would be two particles. It's rare that you see one particle with two peaks. It's like the Mount Kilimanjaro. Okay, so we can measure. So what we can do as experimentalists, we can just measure and measure and measure, and we can measure its spin. We can see if it's spin zero. And we can do everything to try and see whether or not the Higgs is a standard model particle. Why did I say dream or nightmare? I'm just telling you that all the theorists that I know feel like this could be the worst nightmare of their lives, especially if they don't have tenure yet. Okay, imagine this. We have a standard model. It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And it predicted a Higgs, and we found a Higgs, and then we see nothing else, and the Higgs is just the simplest thing, and there's no surprises. What are they going to do? What are we going to do next? What is our next accelerator? It's not clear. So for instance, there's the big LHC. That's very creative. Remember, this is the lake. This is the LHC. This is the Jura Mountains. you can just build a very, very, very big LHC, 80 kilometers. Or, you know, you could build any, 47 kilometers, whatever. And then you have to find someone to pay for it. Or you can build, this is, the big LHC would be proton-protons colliding, for instance. Or you could collide electrons and positrons, the clean energy, and you could look exactly at 126 GeV, and you could study the wazoo out of the Higgs. But again, you have to get somebody to pay for it. Or this is even greater. You can make a muon collider. Muons decay in 10 to the minus 6 seconds. That's quite an engineering challenge. So protons are stable, so you can accelerate them. But you're going to make an accelerator with things that decay. That's kind of weird, but it's kind of exciting also. However, we found something at 125. We don't know what it is. It's probably the Higgs. I think it's a dream for people of all ages. I mean, I was thinking about that. I mean, is it a dream for my graduate students? I think so. It's the most exciting thing. You've got a new particle. It's never been measured. Nobody else has it. You can measure whatever you want about it. That's an incredible dream, okay, for the experimentalists. The other thing we can do as experimentalists is the theorists, who are absolutely brilliant, come up with new theories every day, and we can just rule them all out. That's really fun. Because you know what's great about, this is the great thing about theorists, but I'm in love with theorists. You rule out a theory, they come up with a new one. It takes about, I don't know, usually 4 or 5 days. Sometimes the really new ones, you know, a year or two. But the theorists are full of ideas. So ruling them out and making up new ones seems like something we can sustain for the next 300 or 400 years. We could build a new collider just to look at the Higgs. A dedicated collider, but someone has to pay for it, okay? Then we just, I could spend the next 20 years just looking. I think this is lovely. I think this is lovely. But there's a lot of people who don't feel the same way I do, and many of them are in therapy. Many people believe that no one will give us money to make a new accelerator unless we find something that wasn't expected. There's an incredible idea that if you find something expected, it's not that great. In fact, there's people going around saying that we didn't really discover the Higgs. We just sort of checked whether it was there. It's back to the pig thing. Yeah. I got to tell you, you know when you've discovered something because, again, it's that feeling you have inside. Nobody can tell you anything else about that. We discovered something. I don't know what it is. Okay, so what the theorists, a lot of them, think that the standard model we have, and I haven't talked about this, is not so nice. It has some problems. It has some really big numbers, which you have to subtract together to get a really small number. Okay? For instance, there's the fact that a lot of theorists believe that these forces really aren't, they're just manifestations of one force. So if you go to high enough energy, the beginning of the universe, it'll just be one force. So all the couplings I was talking about, all the strengths of all the couplings will become one. And that's called grand unification. So they came up with this really cool idea called supersymmetry, where every particle that I showed you, that would be a really long talk, actually, if there was supersymmetry, twice as long. Every particle has a partner, and if the particle was spin 1/2, its partner is, say, spin 1. So for every fermion, there's a boson. For every boson, there's a fermion. And this theory, these are our particles, and these are the superparticles, like squarks, leptons, and this lepton. This solves a really nagging problem in the standard model. However, if it really were a symmetry, these particles would have the same mass as these particles. But they don't at all. We can't find them at all. Like, the electron is really not very massive. And this electron is, like, more than 500 GeV. I mean, so this is the idea that theorists have. And you got to love them for this. This is the 1 over the strength of the coupling. Remember I talked about these couplings. This is a strong force, weak force, and electromagnetic force. Oh, dear. As I go up in energy, they don't meet. But when I add supersymmetry, all of a sudden, I see the 3 forces with 1 coupling strength, which is really a very beautiful idea. Unfortunately, as far as I can tell, there is no supersymmetry. But the theorists really want it. So, what are we doing? I think I've tried to explain to you what we found. I'm trying to tell you that the theorists are unhappy. The experimentalists are happy for a while. But even if we found supersymmetry, then what? Is it really over? I don't think it can possibly be over. I think we're going to go through this whole thing. We'll find something. They'll come up with an idea. We'll knock it down with a big bat. And then they'll come up with a better idea. And eventually, they'll figure out the exact structure of space-time. And then everyone will be wetting their pants. This is what I think is going to happen. So I'm very excited by this. What are we doing? We're trying to understand that kind of symmetry, the underlying symmetry. We're trying to understand space-time. And we wouldn't be a bad idea to understand the Big Bang. Here's the Big Bang, my last slide. This is what we think it might be. Time is going this way. Temperature is going this way. Energy is going this way. This is where we're worrying about these problems. Here, way back here, are the energies that we're probing with the Large Hadron Collider. So part of our brains are back here, and then our houses are here. This is today. So I hope I gave you a little bit of an idea that it's not going to be a nightmare. It's going to be very exciting. But we're going to have to rely on the theorists because they need to come up with some ideas. Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions. Let's take at least 3 questions.
Thank you for the talk. I appreciated hearing how you felt on the day that the Higgs was possibly discovered. We also heard that you were the first tenured female physicist at Harvard. Would you tell us how that felt and how the beginning of your time at Harvard as a professor and as a female physics professor felt?
I didn't feel that tingly feeling, but I think it was the first time I've ever gotten drunk. Is that too honest? I love being at Harvard. Harvard's a great place because everybody is so convinced that they're brilliant that you're not a threat. And I love teaching. I love being a teacher, and I also love being, I love the idea of being a female professor and not having to be a goody-goody. Is it weird being a woman in a department of a lot of men who think, are you a physicist?
I'm studying at
Perimeter. Oh, yeah. Okay, well, you know what I'm talking about. You know what? You just gotta really push your reset button every day. Mine is right under here. It's great. I think there's lots of incredibly smart young women going into physics, way smarter than I was then, and just imagine now. Well, you saw. So I think, anyhow, there's way more women, and it feels great.
Question number 2.
The particle was created by pure math, which is not absolute since Riemann changed Euclidean axioms. So the particle is highly hypothetical, which explains both the nightmare and the dream. And my question is, why was the particle named the God particle, which turns quantum physics into a religion, just like Hawkins did?
You know the story, right? This is the guy I worked for when I was...
I don't know the story.
Oh, yeah, the story is... Oh, that's a good story.
Why is it
the... Okay, the story is that Leon Letterman, when he wrote the book, wanted to call it the goddamn particle. Excuse me. I didn't mean to, you know... Because it's a goddamn particle, not the God particle. But they wouldn't allow him to curse in the book. So they just called it the God. It doesn't have anything to do with God, as far as I know.
And question number three.
Thanks very much for the talk. It was great. I feel smarter than when I came in here. Not much, though. Will this lead to anything in dark matter and dark energy?
Ah, that's a really good question. So the Higgs, the dark matter, we think, is massive, obviously, because it suffers the gravitational force. So the Higgs has to couple to dark matter. So what would be really cool is if you measure all the Higgs couplings incredibly well, and you find that all the probabilities don't add up to one. Maybe the Higgs is decaying to dark matter, but we can't see the dark matter. We won't be able to see it in here because we have an electromagnetic detector and it doesn't interact electromagnetically. So yes, I think we may be able to say something about dark matter in maybe 30 years, 20, 10. I think if the Canadian physicists on ATLAS are working on it, it's really going to go fast.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Melissa Franklin, thank you.